This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Brian Wiegand was proud to be fired from his first job out of college at a New York financial firm. It gave him time, he figured, to start his own company, time to call on potential customers and build the business. That first company, it turned out, was just the beginning. Brian has started seven tech-based companies and successfully sold four of them. His biggest win, Jellyfish.com, was acquired less than 2 years into its existence by Microsoft Corp for a reported $50 million. Brian, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you. I appreciate the time and have a chance to tell a little bit about my story.
Well, let's start in on it. You grew up in modest circumstances in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, got a degree in economics from University of Wisconsin-Madison, and left for New York City for a plum job at FactSet. You were on your way. Then you were fired. What happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, coming out of college, really kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. And I was evaluating a number of different offers. And this, ironically, was a smallish company that was a pre-IPO company. And I had to move out to New York City, which was great from Madison. But it allowed me to kind of understand who I was, what I was good at, what I wasn't good at. And so, you know, as I was starting to do the job working with investment banks and money managers, there was clearly a market need that I could kind of quickly see that was not being met just from talking to customers. And so I really wanted to attack that. And I kind of partnered with someone in my kind of recruiting class there. There was about 100 employees at the time. Now it's thousands of employees. So it's been a very successful company. I really, you know, took that on, and they kind of encouraged a little bit of, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit, since it was a small company. And so I ended up completely focusing on that and pitching the management team a whole new direction with a whole new product. And so I went all in on that, and it kind of took over all of my energy and all my efforts. And so my job that I was hired to do was starting to kind of suffer a bit. I tried to do the best I could to balance. And so it ended up where the new direction was creating problems. And so even though it was really supported and really encouraged, everything, it was great. It just, the tensions grew and grew and grew. And I realized that that's what I really wanted to do, is create and build and do something entrepreneurial, even within inside this company. And so that's when they ended up letting me go, because my focus was too far onto this new product at that stage.
So early on, you discovered you wanted to do it your way.
Yeah, I just saw a market need, an opportunity with a client base. And it was, you know, half the company was really encouraging. Most of the company was really encouraging me. And then to say, hey, that's great, Brian, but go do this and earn your time for another year or two, just doesn't work for me. But it was one of the biggest turning points for me. One, I learned a lot about who I am and what I'm good at. And it catapulted me into this, you know, entrepreneurial direction, which is great. At the time, it was depressing, but now it's great.
So let's talk about that first company. You were fired, and you had an idea for working with restaurants in New York, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously dating me, you know, making me pretty old here. This is in the mid 90s, but there wasn't a lot of internet activity. It was just kind of emerging. Bezos just registered Amazon.com, the domain name. I remember seeing that as this new bookstore. So it was in these really early stages, and I was living in right outside of New York City. And I thought, you know, there's all this delivery and there's really no connected way to kind of make that easier. So I just thought, let me just go down door by door by door and say, hey, would you be interested in getting electronic orders? And so I thought, why not put that together? And that seemed like a really cool idea. And so I started to do that. That was a company called Edine, E-D-I-N-E. And I was literally taking the train to the city every day and just going restaurant to restaurant to restaurant. And I got to the spot where I needed to kind of create a corporation or an LLC or for Edine. And I noticed that there was no way other than spending $2,000-$3,000 with a lawyer to make that to happen. And I didn't have that kind of money. So I thought, well, gosh, there's gotta be a lot of companies kind of thinking about creating these new companies. And so then I evaluated more of a scalable approach for my time as opposed to go door to door. Even though I signed up about 50, 60 restaurants at that point, I decided to switch gears and provide a service to help other businesses to incorporate.
So you started Biz Filings, and you got that humming. You were, you know, helping companies incorporate, and you started getting a lot of business. Then you had a partner in Wisconsin. You decided to move back to Wisconsin. Tell about how your move corresponded with moving Biz Filings to Wisconsin.
He was coming out of law school and was in Wisconsin in his kind of parents' house. And I was in my apartment just outside of New York. And this was starting to work where we were getting a lot of business. And I thought it'd be better if we could be together and, you know, start to add team members and others. And so it was a decision to either stay there or go back to Wisconsin. So I went back to Wisconsin. And my server in my computer was everything, you know, basically everything in my desk in my basement that I was working on. It was the actual website was hosted there. And I built all that myself, learned how to do that. And so on my way to, there was no cloud-based web hosting services back then. So I literally had to unplug the server, which the site went down then, and then drove to Wisconsin in the car. I got a speeding ticket along the way because I wanted to get plugged back in on the other side. So it was like 13 hours of downtime for the website, but then I got to the other, to the Madison location and plugged it back in, and we were back in business. And you know, that was probably at the time, maybe another $500, $600 or $1,000 of revenue lost just by having the server down for 15, 20 hours.
The server being your computer, right?
Yeah, my computer, right? It literally was my computer and the server, which is unheard of, right? That's not the way it works today, but
times have changed.
For sure.
So you talk about how in every company you've had, you've taken a big risk. And the big risk you took with Biz Filings was you bought a lot of keywords. You spent tens of thousands of dollars, right?
Well, this is just when the search engines were really starting to be a prominent, you know, Yahoo was there, was a directory based, but then these other search, Excite, Lycos, AltaVista, some of these names that aren't even around anymore. These were new search engines, and there was this new advertising opportunity, intent-based advertising, where you could buy a banner on top of the search for, you know, keywords, which is an unbelievably multi-bazillion dollar industry now. But at the time was this cool new thing where you could capture the intent by buying the ad. So I bought this business with incorporating your business online. It had these really strong keywords, incorporate my business, incorporate corporation. And so what I did is worked with these search engines, and they said that I could get an exclusive, which is, again, unheard of today, for that keyword for a year for a fixed fee of $10 or $20 or $30 or $40,000 for the entire year of every search. And so I locked those in and signed those deals having literally no money at all. I just felt intuitively that the business would be strong enough to be able to pay those bills on a monthly basis. And it turned out to be the game changer for me because we brought in so much business by capturing all of that real estate, key game change, risk taking, kind of committing to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of ad expenses that where we had no revenue.
So Jellyfish, your most successful exit, you sold it to Microsoft. What made that work so well?
Well, so I had Business Filings, and then I created another company, Name Protect, which also sold, which was helping in the kind of the same, not incorporating, but do intellectual property searching and protection. So it was kind of in that same kind of legal services, a B2B company. I really was excited about doing something more consumer oriented, direct to consumer, as there was all these new ideas that were coming out and the internet was exploding. And so I really liked the concept of a shopping search engine. There were other ones around at the time, but we really wanted to do a more granular SKU level a shopping search engine. So it wasn't just a generic shopping engine and something a little bit different. And we filed a patent for this concept of SKU level bidding and searching advertising. And it turns out that Bill Gates actually filed the same patent weeks after we did. And so they discovered that we were doing this and executing on it. This was just one of their bazillions of ideas of patents they filed. And there was this natural combustion really quickly. And they contacted us and were very interested in picking us up to kind of take that vision forward for their new search engine, which was Bing, which wasn't launched at the time.
Nice. Another big risk you took getting that patent. Then you worked at Microsoft for a while, but that wasn't your thing. Like, you're not a big company guy. We've established that. So you left Microsoft and you started Alice.com. That was probably your biggest flop. Why didn't that one work?
Yeah, I mean, what I'd learned is back, I had some of those, like you just mentioned, is some of those feelings of being back in this. Now I'm in a corporation out of 100 people, but 80,000 people. And I'm in Madison, their headquarters are in Seattle. And I suddenly just don't feel that valuable. I'm not feeling like I'm adding a lot of value. And it was one of the more depressing times, even though I'm the wealthiest I've, you know, probably ever been after that sale completed. So I really needed to, I left millions of dollars of kind of not an earnout, but just payments for, I call it vesting in peace in Microsoft's giant corporation, but I just couldn't do it. And so I decided to kind of create another company, but I'm also feeling great about my entrepreneurial, you know, I've just sold now 3 companies in a row in the last 6-7 years. So I'm feeling great. So I created and partnered with Mark McGuire and Craig Andler, who's kind of my current co-founder that I'm working with, to create Alice.com, which was an online grocery delivery or toilet paper and toothpaste delivered to your house with free shipping. So this is, you know, 10, 12 years ago, that was a really radical concept. Everyone's like, no, I can go to Walmart and Target. Why would I ever buy that online? That sounds crazy now. Like, of course we buy all this kind of stuff online, but at the time that was a kind of a cool new notion. And so we went all in on that, raised a ton of money. And that ended up, we were kind of ahead of our time. It was probably the most exciting business I've been in. I've raised the most money. I've had the most media, the most excitement, the most, you know, kind of game-changing innovation. But it was just a little too soon. Couldn't, and it's a big idea. And we just couldn't raise enough capital to kind of keep that company going. And we did have a term sheet right before we shut it down for another really nice $50 million plus exit that didn't turn out. So it was one of those so close, but it didn't pan out.
That didn't stop you though. Tell us about your current company, Spin.live. What are you doing with that?
Well, as soon as Alice, I started Hopster, which then was actually another one of my successes, which was an online couponing company. And then once I sold that, vested in the company that purchased there for a few years, that one I did to stay for the 2-year period of vesting. Then created Spin, which is kind of a next iteration of online video shopping. Live commerce is kind of the category, live video shopping. QVC's had this around through a TV distribution model for years, really servicing an older feminine demographic through the television at home. And China really started to leverage this live commerce, live video shopping, kind of a new way using influencers. And it took off in China. In fact, in China right now, 1 out of every 10 purchases online are done via live shopping, which is crazy, even with that stat, when you think about how in the US, we're so far from that. And it's just this new emerging tech about being able to buy and interact and talk like we're doing now, except imagine if this was shopping. Instead of being literally physically at Nordstrom's, I'm talking to a rep at Nordstrom's right now, looking and talking about things I could purchase or need. It's kind of the next kind of generation of, it takes the best of in-person shopping and the scalability of e-commerce and blends it into a new form of shopping, which I think is China's kind of proven out. It's the big part of our future. So I created Spin, that's kind of Spin Live, which is I'm currently working on right now.
Sounds pretty exciting. Maybe we can all come and do a shopping experience with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about your entrepreneurial journey, and really look forward to watching it unfold as we go forward. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, always trying to innovate and create something new.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Craig Markovitz believes a good route to startup success is to begin with a hacker, a designer, and a hustler. And he's definitely the hustler. Craig has used his early training in banking and venture capital, along with an MBA in entrepreneurship, to build operations and fundraising expertise at his own and others' startups. He has co-founded or been an early employee in three startups. One of them, Pittsburgh-based Blue Belt Technologies, which enabled robot-assisted surgery, started in a lab at Carnegie Mellon University and grew to 150 employees. It was acquired by Smith & Nephew in 2016 for $275 million. Craig, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Hey, after business school, you worked in Chicago in commercial banking and venture capital. You went to DePaul University for an MBA in entrepreneurship, and that kindled your interest in startups. What happened there?
So being a banker, working in venture capitalism, it gives you a broad perspective on a lot of different ideas and opportunities, and you get to sit in on a lot of folks' vision statements, right? You start to understand all these different entrepreneurs and their plans for world domination and how you as an investor or a banker, as a partner, can help. And doing that for a number of years, it actually made me passionate about trying something on my own and being, you know, essentially in charge of my own destiny. And so I made the leap from sort of the safe corporate world into the riskier yet more rewarding, in my opinion, world of entrepreneurship.
You must have been wired for that to begin with, huh?
There's a history of risk-taking and entrepreneurism in my family, for sure. My dad, my grandfather, and others in my family were on their own, doing their own thing. And although it can be terrifying at times, as I said earlier, it could also be incredibly rewarding.
Well, you've co-founded or you've been an early employee in three startups. Two of them had exits, but the first one, Casurgica, didn't work out. How come?
It's a great question, man. You know, like unfortunately, the cold hard facts are that most startups, particularly technology-driven startups, fail. And Casurgica is a great example of a company that had incredibly interesting and powerful technology and an extraordinary team, very talented and committed folks working on making that technology a success. And ultimately, in my opinion, the reason that the company was not able to get across the finish line was really related to sort of customer demand. And, you know, as we sort of talk through this over the course of this podcast, I have some recurring themes and some things that I harp on. And one of them is, you know, it's so important to focus on solving customer problems. And Casurgica was an example of a company with great leadership, an amazing team, really cool technology, but really didn't solve an acute customer problem. It solved problems in the marketplace. It was a planning and navigation technology for surgery. And again, very capable and provided a lot of benefit. Unfortunately, it, in my opinion, was the ultimate nice to have. It added value to procedures, it added value to hospitals and to surgeons, but it really didn't have that factor that solved an acute customer problem in such a way that people thought it was a must-have technology. And ultimately, again, in my opinion, is why the technology was not successful.
Sounds simple in retrospect, right?
Well, that's lessons learned, right? And it's sort of a badge of honor in the innovation and entrepreneurship space to have some failures under your belt, because you learn a lot. It's certainly a process.
In 2003, you and two others founded Blue Belt Technologies. It had an awesome positioning technology and predictive algorithms to provide controlled cutting for surgeons who did hip or knee surgery. But you maintain that it was the team, not the technology, that made it successful. Why?
When I talk about the team, and again, it's another one of my recurring themes, you know, Blue Belt had amazing technology, just as many other companies do. And I've yet to talk to an entrepreneur, an inventor, meet a company that doesn't think they have created an extraordinarily innovative and valuable solution. And Blue Belt was no different. We had technology. It had the opportunity to disrupt a huge market. It had the opportunity to create value for customers in a large market. It was not as easy as we thought it was going to be in terms of sort of bringing that technology to market. And the reason that we were able to fight our way through many years of successes and failures and pivoting and challenges and obstacles was related to the team. And in my opinion, in my experience, surrounding yourself with great people that share your morals and values and work ethic, that are committed to technology, that are committed to the mission of the business, is what differentiates those companies that are successful to those that are not. It's all about the people, the team, the support, the culture that you build to execute on a plan to commercialize technology.
Tell us just briefly about that team. The three of you were that hacker, designer, and hustler team. Who were they?
Sure. So we talk about those three sort of complementary skill sets that you want to bring to the table when you start a new company. And the hacker is the technical expert. And my hacker co-founder was a PhD from Carnegie Mellon, whose name was Branko Yaramez. And Branko came out of the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon and had great experiences and perspective on developing and evolving technology in such a way that it was capable, reliable, and impactful to solve a problem in the market. My designer was an orthopedic surgeon, also a Carnegie Mellon grad, named Dr. Tony DeGioia. And Dr. DeGioia represented our user, our voice of customer. And he brought great perspective and experiences as a surgeon to understand the usability priorities of the technology, right? So when you have a technology that has amazing capability, you have to make sure that it is reasonable in time and space in terms of how the user can incorporate it into their practice. And so he was our designer and I was the hustler. The hustler is the business person whose primary job is to make sure there's money in the bank and no one's paycheck bounces and help to direct the strategy and be there as a resource for the team.
So you worked really hard on this 3-year strategic plan, put a lot into it. It was going to take 3 years. You were going to get there. What happened?
It was a great plan. Right? I think you and I talked earlier and I explained some of the details around that plan. And we licensed very early stage technology out of Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute. And I helped to create a 3-year strategy to bring this technology to the point where it was less risky, it was more real, and that we could support its potential impact in the market. And as these things go, that 3-year plan went perfectly. It took 13 years. And that's how it goes in the life of an entrepreneur.
You debated what you had a lot of potential uses for this technology and you settled on spinal surgery. You thought that was going to be where you could make your first market move. What happened?
Sure. So we spent quite a bit of time trying to understand how this technology could affect surgical practice across a variety of specialties. And there's certainly challenges when you have a platform technology. So our technology truly was a platform. We could control a cutting device to shape bone or any rigid structure in the body for any surgical procedure. And our challenge was to try and figure out what our first application might be, right? And how we could get into the market and start to support the impact and the effect that our technology could have on patient outcomes, on the economics of healthcare and surgery. And we spent quite a bit of time doing our customer discovery, attending conferences, talking to constituencies all across the healthcare industry, and ultimately decided that there were some spine procedures that we thought we could provide some extraordinary impact and benefit to. And we started to move down that path and actually raised our Series A funding round based on the strategy to enter the spine market. And it turns out we were wrong. And we were wrong because, similar to the Cosurgica story, we had created a solution. We went looking for a problem. And when we found that problem, it turns out it was a nice to have. People thought it was interesting. People thought it had potential. But the analogy that I use is, we didn't bring a fire extinguisher to the room where someone's hair was on fire, right? And they had to have us. So we had to pivot. We had to think about what did we learn as we developed the strategy to get into spine procedures as our initial market opportunity? And how could we take those learnings to redirect our energy and effort and priorities? And ultimately went into knee replacement surgery and started there. And that was effectively the correct decision because that allowed us to get a toehold into the marketplace, allowed us to prove the capability and impact of our technology, and then allowed us to grow from there.
That's the power of the pivot.
When I teach at Carnegie Mellon now, and I work with lots of young entrepreneurs, and I tell them they're in a great position as they start their own company someday. They never have to go back to their board. They never have to go to their investors and say, we have failed. Right, I did. The concept of pivoting, the idea between the lean entrepreneurship strategies didn't exist when I started Blue Belt. So when we made that mistake around the spine strategy, I had to go to the board and investors and say, I was wrong. I made a mistake. But this next generation of entrepreneurs, they never have to say that. They can go to their board, go to their investors and say, great news, we're pivoting.
7 years into its life, Blue Belt Technologies got an investment from a private equity firm, which brought in a new CEO. So you were going to leave the company. That's what you do. But then you decided to stay on as chief operating officer. Why did you do that?
Sure. So as we took in this new investor, the priorities of the business changed. So up until that point, we were really focused on making this technology real, productizing it, thinking through our regulatory strategy, understanding how to build a strong intellectual property portfolio to protect the novelty and value of our technology. And once we started to execute on that strategy, the new priority of the business was to get into the market. Right? You really didn't have anything until we had a product that people could buy, right? I mean, that's where you generate value. That's where companies get exponential increases in valuations. When you prove that you have a solution that can be ubiquitous in the market, people will pay for it. And we needed to bring in expertise that had experience taking technology, taking products to market, building a sales force, building that supported infrastructure that you need when a company starts to put things like robotic technologies into hospitals around the world. And we were very, very fortunate to find a gentleman who had experience in selling capital equipment, who understood the market and the challenges. His name is Eric Timko. And we brought Eric Timko in to be the CEO. And as often the case, when new CEO, new leadership comes in, the old CEO typically leaves. So the plan was for me to remove myself from the daily operations of the business, remain on the board of directors, and just become a resource and be more sort of strategic and the inputs that I provided, the value that I provided to the business. But as Eric and I got to know each other, and this translates back to this importance of your team, right? Of finding great people, of working with folks that share your work ethic, that where you can work on solving common problems together, where you want to spend time and you know, build something great together. And Eric and I soon realized that we were kindred spirits and that we both had the same priorities around our families, around our business, around the people that we work with. And we kind of looked at each other and said, this is kind of dumb. Why are you leaving? And the answer was, that's kind of how it goes, right? You're supposed to leave. I'm supposed to leave. And we agreed that that didn't make any sense in this instance, right? And so I was happy to stay. I didn't care what they called me. If they thought I could help the business be successful, I was going to stay. Eric, to his credit, was very happy to, you know, make sure that I had the resources and the authority and autonomy that I needed to do my job. We both agreed that it was in the best interest of the business, put us in the best position to be successful, for Eric to work on building the outward-facing aspects of the organization, for me to continue to focus on building the internal operations of the business, work together on strategy and leadership, and try to get this business to a point where it was successful. And it's, in my experience, very unique for that kind of situation. And I give Eric all the credit in the world for making the offer and for he and I figuring out a way to make it work. And ultimately, it was the right strategy. We're great friends to this day, and it worked.
Well, it says a lot about both of you that it worked. Congratulations on your success with Blue Belt Technologies, and thank you so much for joining us at Midwest Moxie.
It was my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you for inviting me.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Ellie Ellis. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.